Are you ready to join the AWOD Army? Tune in to the new Sports Radio 910 The Fan. Now at 105.1 FM every day from noon to 3 on AWOD Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Adam Epstein. You're listening to AWOD Radio here on the new Sports Radio 910 The Fan, now at 105.1 FM. Also available on the Odyssey app. Download it today for free. Every day after the show, we post a best of podcast as well as every hour of the show. If you go on Apple Podcasts and you type in AWOD Radio, you'll find each hour of the show plus a full best of hour. It's the greatest podcast out there, and that's just my opinion. But I want everybody to support the show here, and you can do that by rating, reviewing, leave us 5 stars, give a comment, and spread the word. Tell your friends you're listening to AWOD Radio on The Fan. Right now it's time for the only full college football segment here in Richmond. We cover all the college football programs in the state of Virginia. It's time for University Drive.
Let's go to University Drive. Scores, rivalries, rankings, all the college football in the state of Virginia. We'll follow the action all season long.
College football, baby!
University Drive on AWOD Radio.
All right, let's head out to JMU for the Dukes. Joining me on the Hadid Mercer Rug Cleaning Hotline is the voice of the Dukes, Dave Riggert. What's going on, Dave?
Adam, my man, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, and it feels like this Saturday it's going to be an unbelievable matchup, 3:30 p.m., JMU at App State, but it feels like it's a prime spot for App State to have a hangover after the unbelievable win over Texas A&M and the miraculous home win over Troy with College Game Day in town. What do you think, man? Will they have a hangover as they face JMU?
You know, I'm hoping so, but, you know, that's something that we've talked about here locally just on my show is that, you know, they've had – and even go back to the North Carolina game in which they scored 40 points in the fourth quarter and lost 63-61. So this is a team that's had three very emotional, tight, high-intensity games the first 3 weeks of this season. And they went to A&M, too, and got the win. Then they got stuck there as well, so they got back late. And then they had College Game Day, all the pageantry around that, the Hail Mary victory. So there's been a lot of emotion, I think, in that App State program so far, which obviously – it's been great for them up to this point, but you never know. You do see some down weeks once in a while, and that can get to them. So I think the Dukes, they're not counting on it, but it wouldn't be a shock if they had a little bit of a letdown. There's no doubt.
Dave, how important do you think it was for JMU to have this week off in preparation for this matchup here, a tough one against App State?
I think it's been a good time for a week off. Sometimes this early, you don't know if you want a week off, but you know, they had a lot of issues throughout fall camp. They had a little COVID run that went through the team where they were missing a bunch of guys. They've had about 4 guys in the 2 deep that have missed the entire season up to this point, and hopefully they'll be back for this game. So I think it came at a pretty good time. And, you know, they're still trying to kind of figure out their identity. They played, I think, better than most people expected, even the coaching staff, the first couple of weeks, and really kind of shined on both sides of the football. And some of the newcomers – they're trying to kind of figure out exactly what they do best and try and tailor everything to their strengths. And I think they're still trying to figure themselves out. So after a couple games, they can kind of go back to the drawing board. Hey, this worked, this didn't. Most things did work the first couple of weeks, but it gives them a good look to kind of evaluate themselves after a couple of football games. And, you know, you always hear the old adage that you make the most improvement from game one to game two. I think they did that. And now they had a chance to kind of look at what those improvements were and get better, and then have a jump on App State. I don't think there's any question that's going to help, that they had a couple weeks to get ready for this football team and really dive in to what they do. Now, I'm sure they did in the summer and looked a lot of film to get ready, but it's nothing like seeing this year's team on film, being able to see them on Saturday in that game against Troy. I think it was very beneficial for JMU.
What kind of confidence does this fan base have in Todd Senteo? I could totally see him, you know, putting the team on his back here and leading JMU to a last-minute touchdown drive. Doesn't it feel like, you know, that all of Harrisonburg is just excited for him and they've got confidence in him?
Oh, they have jumped on his bandwagon. There is no doubt about that. And rightfully so with the way he's played. I mean, 9 touchdowns. in his two games that he's played. He only played a game and a half. He was taken out at halftime of the Norfolk State game, so he didn't even play the second half of that football game. But he's been phenomenal. He's such a good kid, too. And I think that's probably the biggest reason that folks have jumped on board is because we didn't get to talk to Todd in the spring because it was a quarterback competition. They didn't make them available to the media. We didn't hear from him this summer. We didn't hear from him in fall camp. So the first time that we actually got to hear Todd talk was after the Middle Tennessee victory, where he had 397 total yards and 6 touchdowns. And he's a well-spoken young man. He's very mature. You hear his story about how he had some illnesses when he was in high school, and all the Power Five stopped recruiting him, and then he was under the radar a little bit. He got essentially booted from Colorado State because they had a new coaching staff and didn't fit what they were going to do, which essentially is what JMU's doing, and it's working just fine. So it's been kind of a roller coaster road for him, but he's such a well-rounded young man and very well spoken, and I think that's part of why they finally got a chance to hear from him, and now they like him even more to go along with what he's done on the field.
Dave Riggert, voice of the Dukes. Thanks so much, man.
All right, my man. We'll talk to you later.
Yep, let's go over to Charlottesville for the Hoos. From UVA and Wahoos 24/7, it's Jackie Franchulli. What's going on, Jackie?
Hey, how's it going? UVA won, so it's a little better in Charlottesville.
Absolutely. And so you got a big matchup here Friday, September 23rd, as UVA faces Syracuse at Syracuse, a 3-0 Syracuse team that's really started the season well, and they're relying on their their running game. It's going to be a tough test for the Cavs. What do you think?
Yeah, it's certainly going to be a tough test to them. Not only are they facing a team in a dome, which is a different experience for a lot of these guys, but they're also facing their former offensive coordinator, Robert Anai, and Florida quarterbacks coach Jason Beck, who obviously is very familiar with the offense here at Virginia, or at least their offensive playmakers. So it's going to be, you know, a lot of emotions too there. So you can't really negate that side of it. Obviously, it's human nature. But as far as the game, it's going to be a tough test for this UVA offense who got some momentum going against ODU. If you look at Syracuse's defensive line, they run some creative blitzes. I think Tony Ely used the word exotic at certain times. So they're going to have to be a team that does stay ahead of the chains. If they go back, it's a little harder on those third and longs when you face a Syracuse defense like this. So they're going to have to trust in themselves a little bit more. So it's going to be a tough test for Virginia as far as the offense, an offense that still has some learning to do. They did show some progress against Old Dominion. They racked up over 500 yards of total offense, but they only managed 16 points, and yeah. Brendan Armstrong has not scored a touchdown since the first game of the season, which is not a stat I thought I would ever have to say this season.
Absolutely. I do want to say, Jackie, that matchup against ODU was one of the most exciting endings in college football this season. I mean, just a round of applause to both teams and to the state of Virginia. It was so much fun. ODU got, like, every fourth down they needed to get into the end zone for the touchdown. Brendan Armstrong put his team on his back there, led us down the field for the Cavs to get the game-winning field goal. But you're right. It feels like the offense is, like, stuck in the mud. So many yards, but yet just 16 points. What do you think's been the difference this season with Brendan Armstrong as receivers? Why are they struggling?
Well, I think they're adjusting to this new scheme. You know, Tony Elliott touched on it a little bit during his press conference today, is that the way Robert and I set up his offense last year, it was more of a freelancing type of offense where they just kind of go out and make a play, while his offense and Des Kitching's offense is more schematic, more about going through your progressions, more about working on timing. So it's an adjustment for a guy like Brendan Armstrong who's used to winging it. So what Tony Elliott wants Brendan Armstrong to do, as long as his wide receivers, is work on that timing, work on that communication with each other. But also, as far as Brendan, is work on his game management skills. You know, I think the biggest thing that highlights that is if you watch the ODU game again, his first fumble in midfield when he had the ball and he fumbled it after he picked up the first down, he needs to be self-aware situationally that he had already got the first down instead of trying to muscle his way for extra couple of yards, just go out of bounds or slide. So I think that's something that he's trying to teach this team is football intelligence. That's the phrase that Tony Elliott used. So I think it's just them adjusting to new scheme, adjusting to not being the freelance more, and that takes time. So the good news is they're 2-1, and they're showing that progress now where at least you know, compared to 2 weeks ago where they couldn't do anything on the ground or do anything at all on offense. They managed 1.6 yards per carry against Illinois. They were able to come out and have a balanced offense against ODU.
Jackie works for Wahoos 24/7 on 24/7 Sports. Thanks so much, Jackie.
Thanks for having me.
Yep, let's go over to Blacksburg to preview the Black Diamond rivalry. And on the Hadid Mercer Rug Cleaning Hotline is Brian Siegler from the Boundary Corner Podcast. Brian, how are you, man?
Doing good, Adam. Thanks for having me on. It was a pleasure last time for ODU. I got that one wrong. We'll see if I can do better this time.
Yep, Thursday, September 22nd, a Thursday night game, West Virginia at Virginia Tech. And I saw the stadium is already sold out. It is going to be rocking this Thursday night.
Yeah, it's sold out. This is going to be probably one of the better college football experiences you can really be at. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to make the game, but anyone that's going to be there is going to really get a show, especially on a Thursday night in Blacksburg.
It feels like Virginia Tech defensively has to get better at tackling in open field and get off the field on third down. What are your keys to victory as they face West Virginia, who's 1-2 on the season, but hasn't looked bad?
Yeah, it's really kind of strength on strength. I mean, our defense has played well in spots for most of the year so far, and their offense has really gotten it going with that Graham Harrell air raid. So the biggest thing is going to be, I think, third down on both sides of the ball. We need to get off the field on third down as a defense, and we need to start converting at a better clip on offense so we can turn some of these drives we've had into more points, because that's been the biggest struggle so far, is generating points with the offense.
I'm wondering, Brian, what does the Black Diamond Trophy and this rivalry mean to you?
It means a lot, and I'm kind of sad that this is potentially the last time we're going to see this for a very long time. We don't have West Virginia on the schedule, at least for the foreseeable future. So, I mean, this goes back to when I first started following Virginia Tech as a kid in the 90s, you know, watching those Big East games, watching Michael Vick lead them to the Miracle in Morgantown victory in the 1999 season. There's just so many big games, and the rivalry runs deep. We're talking about, you know, batteries thrown at people in stadiums. We're talking about burning couches after games. This is as pure hatred as it can get in college football, and it's, again, sad that we don't get to experience this with the regularity that we did, you know, back in the 90s and early 2000s.
Grant Wells, the quarterback, I'm wondering what your hot take is on him so far this season. Have you soured on him at all? I mean, he's been up and down. He certainly can, you know, he's got the arm strength. It's just, I think it's the decision-making that he struggled with.
Yeah, and especially ODU, there was a lot of decisions that he made there. He still has a couple of those hospital balls that kind of put his receivers into trouble.
Yeah.
But he's cleaned some things up the last couple of weeks. He had a clean game against Boston College, even though there was a couple balls here or there. Much better game this last week against Wofford. Obviously a step down in competition there, so you don't really know a whole lot of what to take there. But I'll take the performance against Wofford if he can, you know, elevate that performance against a more talented defense like what we'll see in West Virginia. But I've not soured on him yet. I feel like he does give us the best opportunity to win football games this season. We'll see as the season progresses if that's something that I want to see for another 2 years as far as leading this team. But I think he definitely gives us the best opportunity to win this year.
Brian, thanks so much. As always, you can follow the podcast on Twitter at Boundary Corner. Thanks so much, man.
Thank you. Have a good one, Adam.
Yep, I'm Adam Epstein. You're listening to AWOD Radio here on the new Sports Radio 910 The Fan, now 105.1 FM. Welcome back. I'm Adam Epstein. This is AWOD Radio here on the new Sports Radio 910 The Fan, now at 105.1 FM. Want to know, what is everyone talking about when you're at work, when you're at your cubicle, when you see some people in the hallway? What's everyone talking about when it comes to TV shows and movies? Is everyone talking about House of the Dragon? That's what it seems like in my life. Let's get into the latest celebrity gossip, Hollywood news, and the most recent drama on Netflix.
Netflix, the best of streaming services, TV, movies, books, podcasts, and more. We've got you covered on Netflix.
All right, so let's start with that Thursday night football game that was exclusively streamed on Amazon Prime. So Thursday night football from 2018 to 2020, right? They cut it off because of the pandemic. It messed with the ratings. But Thursday night football from those 3 years averaged 15 million viewers. Amazon is expected to be near that with 12.5 million viewers after week one, proving that people will still find the NFL even if it's hidden under a rock and behind cord cutters and streaming services. The Nielsen ratings are yet to come out, but Amazon sports head honcho Jay Marine sent a memo telling employees that the 3 hours of Thursday Night Football delivered the most signups in the history of Amazon Prime. And I was wondering how many people after Thursday Night Football stuck around for a couple hours afterwards to watch Rings of Power, which is their billion-dollar TV show about the Lord of the Rings.
That's a good question.
Right?
I don't know.
From our guy, Brandon Katz, who now works for Parrot Analytics. They put out a nice little graphic here. I'll tweet it at AWOD Radio about the platform and demands from audiences and viewers. So of 100%, all right, 19.4% of users use Netflix. That's number one. Surprisingly, at number two was Hulu. I think that's the rise of The Handmaid's Tale, the FX series, the Bear, also The Boys. Every show that they put on their thing is The Handmaid's Tale, The Boys, you know, The Thursday Night Football. Third place, HBO Max with 11.5% of the viewing. Fourth place, Prime Video. Fifth place, Paramount Plus. Sixth place, Peacock. Man, Disney Plus was behind Discovery Plus.
Disney Plus is behind that and Peacock? Wow.
Yeah, and not even making the list was Apple Plus. So I guess they desperately need a new season of Ted Lasso. Cheek, what did you want to bring to the table here on Netflix?
Well, I finally watched a movie for only the third time this entire month. I'm most of the way through it. I had to get some sleep, but I watched Singles, which is set in the 90s grunge era in Seattle. It's very good. Thoroughly enjoying it. Matt Dillon and Bridget Fonda. I'm very much enjoying the Bill Pullman, who played the president Independence Day, of course. And I'm seeing Pearl tonight. I'm very excited.
How about the list of movies that we put on your watch list?
Working on it.
Like the Brendan Fraser movie, Tarzan.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'll watch that if you go see Top Gun.
All right, you're right. You put it back on me. Have you seen the trailer yet for Andor? It looks really good.
I've seen some of it,
So that's going to be the newest Star Wars series. And it takes place, right after the events of Rogue One?
I thought he died in Rogue One.
That's what I thought, too. But I think it takes place right afterwards. It's going to be 8 episodes in the series. And it's getting a lot of positive feedback here. A lot of people saying online, this is the most visually detailed and richly textured Star Wars series to date.
Okay, it's a prequel. Okay.
Oh, it is
a prequel. So that makes sense. Diego Luna's great. He's great in Bloodfather, which is very underrated from a few years ago. I'm hoping they go some sort of different route with it because I've become very jaded with Star Wars.
Yeah, I have too. But you know what? I'll be honest with you. I just watch it because it's Star Wars, and I'm never going to hate on anything Star Wars. But I did hate episodes 8 and episodes 9. And I can't believe they ruined Rey's character. I thought Rey, or is it Ren? No, Rey. Kylo Ren and the girl Rey, played by Daisley Ridley, right? Mm-hmm. She's a great actress, beautiful. I thought her character was great in episode 7. And then they just ruined her character episodes 8 and 9. And they made her a villain, which was so stupid.
I hate 9 just because it's a complete mess. I've never walked out of a theater I didn't walk out like the definition of walking out, like middle of the movie, but after the movie, I walked out. I've never left a movie like angry. I was just like, none of that made sense, and all of that was dumb, and I'm done.
Cheek, you do love horror movies and TV shows. Did you see Netflix unveiled a spine-chilling trailer for Mike Flanagan's The Midnight Club?
Oh my God, the trailer's out?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, I'm watching that as soon as it's done with the show. I saw the Hellraiser trailer drop too, so we're getting a lot of stuff this next month and a half.
Yeah.
It's spooky season. Let's go.
Yeah, it really is. But I am watching House of the Dragon every week, and I can't tell you how much I love it. I mean, I really do. So this week, after I watched episode 5. I went back and rewatched episode 3 because I had fallen asleep during that one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so good. He kills the crap out of the crab guy. And just Daemon Targaryen is like Jon Snow in that episode. He's just killing everyone. The body count is incredible. He's so good with his sword. He's running all over the place. I felt like episodes 4 and episodes 5 have let me down a little bit. The plot is thickening, but there's less action. And so next episode, I'm hoping for a ton more because you'll get the first of the 2 time jumps. Remember, I talked about this a few weeks ago. Episode 5 will be like a 3 to 5 year jump, and then the next episode will be a 10-year jump. And that'll set up the end, the final 3 episodes of season 1. And then, of course, it'll come back for season 2. It's already been renewed for season 2, and HBO is getting amazing ratings for it right now. Cheek, is there anything else you wanted to bring to Netflix today?
I don't know if I have anything. I'm going to watch the Midnight Club trailer. I'm very excited for that. Might see Moon Age Daydream tomorrow. What would you rate House of Dragons season 1 so far? How would you rate it, like 1 to 10?
An 8 out of 10.
Okay.
Certainly.
That's good to know.
First 3 episodes, I thought it was like good, great, awesome. Episodes 4 and episodes 5, like, let me down a little bit, but I can feel they're developing something, right? We're getting to find out who is the villain of this season and all that stuff. So I'm enjoying it a ton. And my favorite thing about it is that it's appointment viewing now, right? Sunday night, as soon as the Sunday night football game, you know, feels like it's getting out of hand, I throw on House of the Dragon on HBO Max. I just wish they would have titled it House of Dragons, right? They didn't need, it's like they're trying to copy Hulu. They had to throw a the in there. House of the Dragon. Are you kidding me? I'm Adam Epstein. You can always tweet me if you want to give me a movie or a TV show recommendation or a book or a podcast at AWOD Radio. Or you can call us 833-804-0910. You're listening to AWOD on The Fan. Welcome back. I'm Adam Epstein. You're listening to AWOD Radio. And of course, we know yesterday was a misery Monday, but not every Monday needs to be a misery Monday. All it will take is for the Commanders to score 72 points, and that's all it'll take, and we'll beat the Eagles, right? Because, you know, our defense will probably give up 71. All right, joining me right now on the Hadid Mercer Rug Cleaning Hotline to discuss and preview the game from this weekend is David Harrison. What's going on, David?
Hey, Adam. How are you?
I'm doing all right, man. It feels like this defense, you know, it's the same issues that we had last year. And they had the entire offseason to, I don't know, bring in a linebacker, you know, or I don't know, get more help at the secondary or bring in more help at the DN position without Chase Young. Do you feel like this defense is just stuck and we're just not going to get better? Or do you see, you know, a bright light at the end of the tunnel here and maybe Cam Curl coming back will be enough?
Yeah, I think the good news is that the defense is naturally going to get better, at least to within a certain, you know, amount of expectation because of the return of some of the talent that's missing on the field right now. Guys like you just mentioned, Cam Curl, eventually when Chase Young gets back on the field. You know, again, going back to last year, he's kind of one of those players that was identified as kind of needing to kind of pick up the assignment part of football and everything else. So we'll kind of get our first look as to just how much of that is really sunk in. And then, I mean, Sam sidelines and you know, in practice and stuff, it can also kind of help a guy like Chase grow a little bit too, because it's always, you know, I kind of go back to like the parent-child relationship, right? Once you become a parent, you kind of see and understand why things are said and things are done that when you were your child. And, you know, not to say that Chase Young is a child by any means, but he's kind of seeing things from the sideline where the coaches see things and kind of sees the repercussions from the outside angle. And sometimes that can kind of drive a point home a little bit more. So if he's seeing some of his teammates do some of these things, you know, get out of their gaps, get out of their lanes, not fulfill, you know, what the coaches are telling them to do and seeing the repercussions, it can potentially help kind of accelerate his understanding of why things are being asked of him the way they are and help him kind of stay disciplined within those things when he comes back. But I think those things are going to naturally make the team better. But I think some of these deficiencies and also, you know, Jonathan Allen getting healthier obviously will help as well. But I think some of these deficiencies, you know, I think they just kind of are what they are at this point in time, and it's on this coaching staff and these teammates to pick each other up as much as they possibly can to get as much out of each other as they can as well.
David, the most frustrating thing about the game was not the game. It was after the game, hearing Amon-Ra St. Brown tell reporters, quote, "They had a busted coverage. All week, we kind of knew they didn't handle bunches really well. And we knew that going into the week, I was kind of surprised. I mean, no one was there. Busted coverage. I think it was a great play." I mean, you hear that quote that the Detroit Lions watched enough film to know that Washington doesn't handle bunch formations well, and then they took advantage of that. So frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to be kind of inside the meeting room. Obviously, that's not something that's going to happen, especially now. If it wouldn't happen anyway, but now the game is over, it's really not going to happen. But, like, what is the context of that conversation? Because, the spoils of war go to the success or the winner and all those things. So, he says what he says and all that, and that's great. But at the same time, when you kind of look at the secondary, especially with the health of Cam Curl kind of being in question, you look at Benjamin St. Juice, second-year player, Derek Forrest, second-year player, and if you kind of get into these bunch formations, you force guys like that kind of into situations where they have to read a play, react, and do it appropriately while also communicating with their teammate. I mean, it's really not a far stretch to kind of say any defense that's got some youth players in these situations could be susceptible to things like that. So when you hear something like that, like it's not all that hard to understand that, but what's really striking to me is the fact that one of those busted plays in a bunch formation actually appears on film. And again, that's always kind of a tricky subject too. You don't really know the assignments, but looking at the other side of the defensive formation, what everybody else did in the secondary, it looked like they were in man and were not passing off crossing receivers. So if your guy crossed under or over a guy, you're supposed to follow them and suit and stay with them. And if that is correct, then there's actually one of the biggest plays of this game early on actually was a busted assigned by William Jackson, not one of the young guys. So that it's kind of, were the Detroit Lions looking to take advantage of some of this youth and then just kind of ended up stumbling into where they actually caught a veteran sleeping on one of these crossing patterns, or is that something they saw in film as well from last year kind of bringing into this year? Because, again, every coach's staff is a little bit different. We've heard this one in Washington talk about how last year's tape, you watch it, you look at it, but you don't take a whole lot of stock in it just because teams are so much different. But maybe that's something that Campbell and his staff in Detroit saw from last season that they thought they could take advantage of, because the secondary and the defense really is, from a personnel standpoint, so similar to what we saw last season.
Yeah, David, it just felt like the defense just simply effed up, and they effed up multiple times. And for me, watching it, it felt like watching the play happen live. I knew they messed up because I'm watching it, and you can see you got two guys guarding one, And so at what point do the play do you guys say, oh, I need to bail off this guy? We're obviously not supposed to be double-teaming him. Or just Washington, their players just decide, you know what? Screw it, The play's over. Let's just look bad together and both guard the same guy. It's so frustrating. It was so obvious that it was a blown coverage because you never have a double team like that. And so you just had two guys make the same mistake. Joined by David Harrison. You can follow him on Twitter at dharrison82. He joins me on the Hadid Mercer Rug Cleaning Hotline. David, I tweeted at AWOD Radio yesterday, does Jack Del Rio make it past week 3? And before I give you a chance to respond, I just want to read off some of the answers I got at AWOD Radio. Mm-hmm. I got one. I've always been on the mindset that he'd get to week 4 and the defense is still a mess. I hope not. He had the same MO with 4 teams now. Considering his offseason, I'd be shocked if he was allowed to make it past week 3. I doubt it. Philly is going to crush our defense. He will, but he shouldn't. He will last the season. Ownership let all these other guys leave the building. They're not going to let him leave. Tailgate Ted says, yes, Rivera won't give up that buffer he gets with Del Rio taking the defensive bullets. I do believe he'll eventually get fired, but later through the season. And that's what I feel like, man, because I feel like he can't fire Jack Del Rio because he knows all those bullets will be aimed at him next.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a valid point. There's a lot of things that kind of go into these decisions. It's not as simple as, is the unit doing well? Are they not doing well? Are you part of the solution? Are you part of the problem? There are, in circumstances, I'm not saying that this one specifically, but yeah, I mean, in any organization, when these decisions are being talked about, there's multiple layers to this whole thing. So as far as, will Jack Del Rio make it past week 3? Like, yeah, I think he's going to make it past week 3. I think you really have to kind of go beyond the first quarter of the season before you really kind of find out who you are as a team. And even some of this, like some of these adversities, right? Like we go back to Jacksonville, and I remember when we talked after that game, I kind of mentioned, like, it's really good that, you don't want to see the turnovers, and obviously you don't want to see a team like Jacksonville kind of come back, get back into the game, get a fourth quarter lead and all those things. But when you come at it on the other side, the victor, now you can go back and you kind of learn from that history from an angle of happiness and success and try to build on top of it. When you come out of adversity as the loser, sometimes it's a little bit harder, but at the same time, sometimes that's where you really find out who has the dog in the fight versus the fighting dog and all that stuff. And that's where you find out who the guys on this team that are part of your future and part of your solution and who are part of the problem. And to a certain extent, the coaching staff already kind of knows who the problems are. It's just a matter of either fixing those problems or replacing those problems. And honestly, that's kind of where I am at with this coaching staff is when I start seeing coaching staff, and whether it's Washington or any other coaching staff, really start to identify players as being the problem, whether they're by name or just saying, a player blue coverage here, a player this, that's an accountability tool. It's kind of the last straw of saying, guys, we've talked about this. We've gone over this in meetings. We've watched the film. We practiced it. We walked through it. We've done all those things. You're really leaving us no other choice now but to publicly put the problems at the feet of who are causing them. And once you get to that point, you still, as a leader, as a coach, have to make decisions. And if you're going to start publicly putting people out there for accountability, then it's also accountable on you as a leader to, at some point in time, if that player is not responding to all of these methods, then the final method is removing them from the situation and giving a guy who may not be more talented, but may just by the nature of doing the job the way it's prescribed to be done, may actually be better for your entire unit.
David, the offense, in my opinion, has had way too many three and outs in just two games. And it feels like that is because too many negative plays on first down. And then you have all these short passes that we do. And when they work, they're great. But they're, behind the line of scrimmage or they're 1 yard forward. And when the timing is off, those big plays become just a 1 yard or 2 yard gain. And then you set us up with a third and, terrible third and long. And then also I blame Antonio Gibson, who has not been good enough in his first or second down rush attempts, that's putting us behind in the sticks too many times. What do you think is the biggest issue for these three and outs?
Yeah, this offense is designed – it looks to me like this offense is designed to be a jab-jab hook type of offense. And they want to get a couple of good runs. They want to get a couple of good short passes, maybe get, Curtis Samuel to juke a guy out of his cleats and then get some extra yards, or Jahan Dotson or whoever it's going to be. And then eventually, every 7, 8 to 12 plays, try to take the big shot and land, the cross or the hook or whatever you want to call it. And when the jab isn't landing, it's really hard to really set that up. And that's part of the problem. And to me, when I look at this team and you kind of look at them coming into the season, this team really misses Brian Robinson. I really look at this and I say that's really part of the catalyst of this whole thing. Curtis Samuel last season was a very big reason why this offense got bogged down, even with Taylor Heinicke at quarterback. I think with Heinicke at quarterback and Curtis Samuel is healthy, I think this offense still looks better than what we saw last season. Now, last year, going back to those conversations, this team was missing a really good, Antonio Gibson is talented, but I'm talking about a really good, kind of a powerful back that can punish teams up the middle.
Right.
And that's why they went out and drafted Brian Robinson Jr. That's what we saw in training camp in the beginning of the preseason and throughout the preseason until the unfortunate incident, and that is missing. And unfortunately right now there's nothing, Jonathan Williams, I think, is a similar type of running back, but he's just not, he's not going to bring everything to the field that Brian Robinson does. I almost kind of look at this though, and kind of going back to what we were just talking about, is there a point in this offense where if you're Scott Turner, Ron Rivera, you guys say, look, this isn't getting it done. So we can either continue to do this knowing it's not getting it done. It didn't get it done last year, or we can put 41 out there and just see if something magical happens, at least for a game, at least for a couple drives, get some momentum going and see what we can make out of it. That's going to be a decision they have to make. But I look at this offense, I really think they're hurting from losing Brian Robinson Jr. because you look at the way the defense has attacked them. If you're the Detroit Lions and you've got, Terry McLaurin, Curtis Samuel, John Dotson on the field, and you've got Brian Robinson in the backfield, you have no choice. You have to respect in between the tackles. You cannot vacate that space between the tackles, or Brian Robinson is going to eat you alive all day long. And what that does is it opens up some screen opportunities, some slant opportunities, some of those quicker passes that we're talking about to be more successful against a more talented defense than what we saw in the Jacksonville Jaguars. When that's missing, the defense now has the opportunity to spread out more, play a little bit more aggressive on the boundaries against those short passes. And when those don't get completed and accomplish what they're trying to do, again, you can't set up the hook or the undercut or the uppercut or the cross or whatever if you're not hitting the jab. And I think that's why you see all of those three and outs. Now, at the end of the day, that's the situation you're in. So from coaching standpoint, a player standpoint, you got to figure it out. You can't just go out there and say, oh, woe is us. We'll just wait till Brian comes back, because the Philadelphia Eagles are not going to come out there and say, okay, well, we'll hand you guys a win because we know you're missing a guy. That's just not how it's going to work. So while that may be the problem, that's kind of what I'm seeing right now, is they're missing that thump in the middle and that accountability tool against the defense. They've got to find a way to figure out whether it's Jonathan Williams or just other things that they try to do to force defenses to play a little bit more contained.
Yep. Hopefully they get the victory this weekend. David, thanks so much, man. Good stuff as always.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah, I appreciate you.
Yep. I'm Adam Epstein. You're listening to AWOD Radio on The Fan. Welcome back. I'm Adam Epstein. You're listening to AWOD Radio here on the new Sports Radio 910 The Fan, now at 105.1 FM, and we've got playoff baseball tonight here on 910 The Fan, as you can hear the Richmond Flying Squirrels, and then they'll be home. So they're in Erie, Pennsylvania today. They'll be home here in Richmond on Thursday for some playoff baseball at the Diamond. It's going to be a ton of fun. Joining me right now on the Hadid Mercer Rug Cleaning Hotline from ESPN is Jason Reed, senior NFL writer, but also the author of The Rise of the Black Quarterback. What's going on, Jason?
Hey, how we doing? Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, Jason, I was working with Dominique Foxworth on his show, I Don't Give a Damn, so I know all about ESPN's Year of the Black Quarterback documentary and the work you did with them. It was excellent. And so I kind of want to know, is that where you came up with the idea for the book, or did the book come before ESPN?
No, the book came right out of that project. And you know, I was going to the airport after the Super Bowl in Miami a couple of years ago, and a literary agent had reached out to me saying that, hey, he had been following this project I had been doing for the year, and he thought there was a book there, and so I said I'd get back to him. Well, when I got to the airport, I'm waiting for my flight, and a different literary agent reached out to me and said the same thing. So I kind of was thinking, well, maybe there's a book here. So like 18 months, so about 2 years later, and about 70 interviews later, we have Rise of the Black Quarterback, What It Means for America.
Yeah, I'm wondering what you kind of meant in 30 seconds or less, maybe, when you say Rise of the Black Quarterback, but then the What It Means for America. Can you elaborate a little further on that?
Yeah, in a nutshell, quarterback is a uniquely American leadership position. If you take it away from the football field, if you lead a project for a big company, you will consider the quarterback of that team, you know, trying to get this project done. If you're a doctor and you're trying to help somebody get through a major medical procedure where many doctors are involved, you're the quarterback of that person's medical procedure. Quarterback inspires. It's the best among us. It's the brightest among us, the best leader. And so when I talk about the rise of the black quarterback, what it shows is that when the playing field becomes somewhat more level, any one of us can become a leader and contribute to the greatest country in the world.
Joined by Jason Reed on our Hadid Mercer Rug Cleaning Hotline. Follow him on Twitter at @JReedESPN. Jason, I've heard you on DC Sports Radio for a long time here, but I want to get your take on my show here on Robert Griffin III, on the way he was treated in DC, not just by the fan bases there, but by coaches and ownership. And do you think it could have gone differently for Robert, for him to succeed? Or, you know, maybe you're like me and you thought, you know, injuries would have always gotten in the way with the way he plays the quarterback position.
Well, how much time do we have? This is a really complex question.
Well, I'm excited to hear your answer.
Okay, well, let me say this. Back in 2016, I did a deep dive on this subject and wrote about, I think, 4,000 or 5,000 words on what happened to Robert Griffin III. And my takeaway from my reporting was that Robert ultimately did a lot of things to hurt himself, that there were many circumstances and situations that occurred with that team, but that the owner, Daniel Snyder, he got involved in a situation in a way that did not help Robert. And between that situation and others with the coaching staff, it really was going to wind up that way all along, unfortunately. So what I would say is, you know, if people want to go back and look at that story, it's on ESPN. The story is Whatever Happened to Robert Griffin III. It was a combination of factors, but Robert has culpability in it as well.
What do you make of Jalen Hurts? Certainly seems like a black quarterback on the rise in the NFL. Jason, I'll be honest, last year I was a hater. I kept saying his arm strength stinks, his accuracy is not good enough. But what after I've seen from the first 2 weeks, it feels like he must have worked with a quarterback whisperer in the offseason. He's a completely different quarterback now.
I mean, you know, it doesn't happen for all these guys overnight. I look at what Hurts did at Alabama and then Oklahoma, and there were lots of knocks on his, you know, the way he was in the pocket, and you know, maybe he didn't do things in a manner that, you know, would be conducive to long range being a great NFL quarterback. Well, look, the jury is still out, clearly. It's only two games for this year, but he's off to a very good start. And I think what this shows is that, you know, teams have to, if they believe they have a guy who can be that guy for them behind center, they got to give him a little time to make it work. You can look at the situation with Tua in Miami. He's off to a good start. I'm not saying either one of these guys are proven superstars yet, but if you give people time and they do have the ability and the organizations rally around them, they have a chance.
Jason, I'm looking forward to reading your book, Rise of the Black Quarterback, and what it means for America. And I'm definitely going to read it because I'm on a roll right now going through a ton of sports books, going through a few of John Feinstein's, Phil Jackson's 11 Rings. I got a really great one from UVA's new head coach, Tony Elliott, Simon Sinek's The Infinite Game. And so, Jason, while I have you on the air here and I'm going through all these books here, and I'm going to absolutely read your book, but maybe you can give me a suggestion of another book that you got some inspiration from, or some just a sports book that you've loved in general.
Oh my goodness! Well, I mean, so many, but John Feinstein's book, you know, A Season on the Brink, about the Indiana Hoosiers basketball program and Bobby Knight, was one of the books that, as a young man, I read, that inspired me to want to be a sports writer, inspired me to really want to do stories where I got beyond just what happens in the game. I mean, that book really had a major impact on my life. There are many others, don't get me wrong. I mean, because I'm an avid reader of books. I really like books on history, not just sports history, but history in general. And Season on the Brink, though, it really was one of the most impactful books on my life.
Man, I'm going to have to check that out. I've done a few other Feinstein books. I liked his one about mid-major sports because I went to VCU and it felt like us and UMBC were featured all over that. Jason, thanks so much, man. Everyone should check out his book today, and you can order copies of it right now at Rise of the Black Quarterback, What It Means for America. Jason Reed, of course, an NFL writer, works for ESPN. He's done been all over the place, man, and I love talking to you, especially about DC sports, man.
Hey, anytime. Thank you for having me.
Yep. I'm Adam Epstein. That was Jason Reed. You're listening to AWOD Radio here on the new Sports Radio 910 The Fan, now at 105.1 FM. So, Flying Squirrels playoff baseball tonight. Trey and Blaine will be on the call from Erie, Pennsylvania. And then back at the Diamond on Thursday. No show tomorrow as the Washington Nationals have a midday game. But be sure to catch us Thursday, as I'll be joined by Bill Roth. We'll do a drive around, what do we call it? The Drive Richmond Highway with Gary Hess. I'm fumbling the bag here right now.
Drive on Richmond Highway.
Drive
Let's
on.
Just go with that.
I'm Adam Epstein. You can get in touch with me throughout the show by always tweeting me at AWOD Radio. Thanks to my producer, Adam Cheek. I'll see you guys Thursday at 12 noon on The Fan.